Randy Haven O'Donnell. I'm Mayor Pro Tem, and I'm sitting in for Mark Chilton in his absence. And the first order of business that I'd like to address this evening is I'd like for us to recognize Sarah Williamson, who is going, this is her last meeting. Sarah, I'm going to present these to you from the board. Sarah has been with the town of Carrboro for 37 years. Yes? And this is her last board meeting.
See you, so you can move those. You know, Sarah's not really retiring. She's going on to play professional poker. Because I have sat across from this woman for 20 years, and she has the best through public hearings, through all kinds of things, and Sarah's just always, always Sarah.
Steady as she goes.
Steady as she goes.
Absolutely. And with that, so thank you, Sarah. We're very much on our mind. Second, I'd like to read a proclamation. Some of you may or may not know that the Carrboro United Methodist Church was founded in 1910, and actually the original site of the church is the Carrboro Century Center site. And so the proclamation reads, Carrboro United Methodist Church Day, whereas Carrboro United Methodist Church was begun July 1910 in the town of Carrboro, North Carolina, and whereas Carrboro United Methodist Church has been in mission to our community, nation, and world for 100 years, and whereas Carrboro United Methodist Church is celebrating its centennial on Sunday, June 27, 2010, and whereas members of the Carrboro United Methodist Church and their friends and families and guests will gather on Sunday, June 27, 2010, to honor and celebrate 100 years of ministry, now, therefore, be it resolved, Randy Haven O'Donnell, the Mayor Pro Tem of the town of Carrboro, North Carolina, do hereby proclaim Sunday, June 27, 2010, as Carrboro United Methodist Church Day in honor and recognition of Carrboro United Methodist Church presence, mission, and ministry to our town this 27th day of June. So thank you, Carrboro Methodist, for all you've done for the community. They're very much involved with the IFC, Scouts, Stop the Hunger Now, the Crop Walk. So we're very, very appreciative of their work in the community. Let's see. So the first item of business is the consent agenda. Mr. Manager?
Could I take care of that other matter before we get to the consent agenda?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
I would like to introduce to the board and to the folks here and the folks who are watching at home our new finance director, Arch McAdoo. Arch, could stand up. Arch will be starting with us on July 26th. Arch is currently the Deputy Finance Director for the City of Durham. He comes to us with other experience in local government and experience at the university level and some other private sector and public sector experience, lots of years of supervision, lots of years as a manager and financial background. So we're just really pleased to have Arch. He's a native of Orange County. And he also is a resident of the town of Carrboro. He has his MBA degree from UNC, and he has a son who's on the football team at UNC. So we're just so pleased to have Arch today. We had a chance to introduce him to the Management Services Department today, and we had a little reception for Arch, and he got a chance to meet a number of our employees. So, Arch, we can't wait until July 26th. Thank you.
Welcome, Arch.
Welcome.
Good to meet you.
Okay. All right. Item one is approval of the minutes of the previous meetings of June 8th and June 15th. Item two is award of construction contract for the 2009-2010 street resurfacing project. Item 10 is approval of an update on energy planning efforts. And item four, if you had a chance to see your email, mm-hmm. we don't have the memorandum of agreement yet, so we'd like to delay this until after the break.
September. Mm-hmm.
And item five is a resolution supporting inclusion of Carrboro in the Triangle Regional Transit Program Alternatives Analysis Process.
Move one, two, three, and five.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in a favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any nays? No. Motion carries. Okay. All right. First item we have is request to adopt the 2010-2011 miscellaneous fees and charges.
On June 15th, you all received a request from Cam Hill for information related to building permit fees for a building renovation, requested a staff report and continued discussion of the adoption of fees to this meeting. We were able, very late in the day, and I apologize for that, but we were able late in the day to email you all a report prepared by Trish McGuire and Mike Canova. I don't know if you've all had a chance to look at that or not. Both Trish and Mike are here. If the board has any questions or if you'd like us to go over any of that report, we're happy to do so.
I've gone over it, and I think other board members have too. Could we please explain to the public what it says, so before we vote on it?
Well, the report just provides some of the background about the fees and provides an option for the board to consider in response to Mr. Hill's request, which for the building permit fee portion would take the replacement and renovation piece of our fee schedule for items not covered by minimum square footage for commercial and adds the following phrase, and renovations to existing commercial buildings located in the University Lake watershed. So for the building permit portion for a renovation that didn't use minimum square footage, then that part of the fee structure would be $275.
Thank you.
So we need a motion to approve the fee schedule.
If this fee schedule is approved, I have a question. If this fee schedule is approved by the board, does that prevent the town from imposing the double fee because the work was started without the renovation, without the permit?
Are you talking about it for future projects?
Yeah.
I don't believe that would change. Mike, you can correct me if I'm wrong, or Bob, but that wouldn't impact that. That's a procedure in place for all of the permit fees.
Now, I will say this to the board. I'll support it, but I'm a very uneasy about the fact that work was done and then it comes to us to make the decision. And I think that's a poor way of process for the board to do so. And so I am concerned about the fact of how it came to us in terms of having someone who started a renovation project and was not penalized, and the staff did what they thought was best applying the current existing structure. So I have some great concerns about that because I don't want anybody else coming back to us and saying, well, you waived his fee and you reduced his fee. Let's reduce my fee, and I can show that I am in an exception.
Joy, I think you're making a great point. I will point out, as we all know, I think Cam emailed us about this a couple months ago, so it's been percolating for a little while. So that's one point I'll say. And the second is, it does seem like this circumstance had some unusual kind of it seems like this situation had some unusual circumstances around it. Just the bid itself was odd. So those are a couple points I would make in response to that.
But that doesn't change the fact. You started the renovation before getting a permit, and that's not what we want people to do.
Yeah, I agree with you, Joel. And, you know, my own interest in this is because, you know, everyone involved in economic development in Orange County, whether it's Chapel Hill, the county, or us, or the chamber, talks about how this is exactly the kind of property we need more of and the kind of businesses we need to attract. So, I want to enable the Hills to succeed with this property.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm saying I'm voting for it, but I do think that when the board looks at it in the future, it's placing us in a precarious situation if people decide, well, I don't understand the code, so I'm going to start anyway, then I'm going to come to the board.
Duly noted.
Move attachment C.
Second. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Nays? Motion carries. Thank you. Our second item is a continued discussion of the minor modification of Valentine.
Yeah, you all had asked that this be continued to this meeting. I think there were a question or two that you wanted answered, and Jeff Cleveland is prepared to provide that updated information for the board.
I don't need to go back over the rest of the project. Okay with that? For reference, this is the proposed phasing plan, the four-phase plan, and two concerns from the board, one regarding greenways and the other regarding the NC86 connection. Pertaining to the greenways, I've added condition 11, which which requires of the applicant prior to phase one final plat approval that this area be given an offer of dedication would be given to the town of this area for public use, and the applicant has agreed to this. Regarding other details with the greenways, I wanted to make clear that in this easement area we don't have a proposed greenway alignment, and we're not exactly sure what that's going to look like in the future. But the existing approved CUP plan does have a greenway alignment that bisects the property and kind of moves in, let's see here. I'm sorry, I thought I had an improved map in here. It's invisible. Please bear with me. Okay, let's see here. Well, nonetheless, it bisects the property and begins where the Legends Greenway ends here and then comes up and terminates at the existing gravel drive here. So that's what the proposed approved CUP plan shows. Just as a reminder, this is a minor modification, a phasing change. This will not change the existing approved conditional use permit. Open space and recreation points for each phase is self-reliant in terms of meeting those requirements. It's important to note that in order for this to work, phase three, an easement has been placed around the play field in order to acquire a few extra points that phase two is in deficit. And an easement will be, it's on the construction plans already that this easement be provided prior to recordation of phase one. And like any other easement, it runs with the land and will be an easement that essentially is an addition to the approved CUP plans. You'll see regarding the old NC86 connection, I've included an attachment email that was sent to the board regarding our addressing of condition number 28. Essentially, our conclusion is that the town satisfied that condition and looking into that issue with NCDOT as far as the location of the road. And then earlier, we also have other indications from NCDOT that a speed reduction in this area is not advised. So I can answer any questions that you might have.
Anyone? Jackie.
why did DOT recommend that a speed reduction isn't advised?
Have you seen the NCDOT letter? It was addressed. It might have been forwarded to you earlier, primarily because they feel, well, on one hand, it's a several-page letter, so I can't really summarize it.
For the audience, could you please summarize?
But I think one of the issues is that enforcement of that lower speed limit is a real problem in that area.
So it's not so much that the road can carry the speed, it's the it gets kind of hairy out there, and if you have people pulling in and out, it's going to get hairier, especially with the trucks going to Eubanks. So I know DOT sets the rules, but I'd like us to continue to advocate for speed reduction there. The more people that live out there, and it's a windy, bumpy, we're playing Russian roulette with that. But I know you can't do anything about that, Jeff, but I think we need to continue pushing DOT for a reduction out there as it becomes more populated.
What is the speed limit out there?
It's 45.
It's 45.
Yes. Which means people are going 55. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I went and drove through the area in question, and it's, you know, you come around curves very fast, and it's always surprising there. So.
And the trucks. I think one thing we can do is to emphasize to the trucks, and a lot of them are public trucks, that they're to obey the speed limit, and we need to really push that with them.
And it's a problem because there's no shoulder.
Right.
And there's
right.
a That's hard place for people to pull over,
mm-hmm.
and officers and things.
And I guess that to some extent, the new phasing does provide an additional opportunity to pursue this question, and that in terms of this condition 28, that if we did achieve the reduction, we would still have the opportunity potentially to consider relocating the road, right? If, you know, if we were able to make any headway over the next year or two, perhaps.
I would think in the context of either a major modification or a rezoning, that would be open, that issue would be opened again.
Well, is it not still open? Because as I read the condition, is that if NCDOT reduces the speed limit, the intersection could be moved.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, has that condition expired for some reason? Why wouldn't that run up until the point when that infrastructure has to be created on the property, or at least some subsequent date?
Wouldn't it depend on what type of infrastructure?
We're talking about a road.
Well, I know, but I'm saying it depends on what is going to be put on phase 3 and 4.
Exactly,
right,
which means it remains an open issue. It's not something we need to resolve this evening.
Let's see what Marty has to say.
I was just going to say the email that we had sent to you in the past, I don't recall the exact date, but what it states essentially is that the
March
condition.
March 6th, by the way.
Thank you. The condition is satisfied with respect to the developer moving forward with construction on the site. So I think it's kind of, you could kind of read it either way as to whether that condition is still means something moving forward. I think what I'm trying to say, to keep this simple, is if the town were able to sway DOT with respect to reducing it to 35, as long as that hasn't been constructed yet, I guess we might check in with the developer, but they probably would be open to moving it.
Yeah, let me be very specific with my question, which is, you know, we have the reference here to construction drawing approval. Would that not now mean construction drawing approval for phases 3 and 4, which we haven't even seen yet?
Yes, I see what you're saying. I think the fact that the staff concluded that the condition was satisfied probably still stands, but we certainly could raise it again when the phase 3 construction plans come in. I do see what you're saying. It's technically not a part of what we're approving at this point, construction plan wise, so we could revisit it at that time.
Right, so I guess what's the basis for staff?
Unless there's a relatively significant change in circumstance between now and then,
we'd be hard pressed to impose a different location for that
intersection on the developer.
I mean, well, I don't understand, because this condition allows us to do that.
Unless there's a change in circumstance, more information, DOT has changed its position. I mean, I would not feel comfortable 2 years from now or a year and a half from now for the town to say, we don't like this, we're going to make you change it. Based
but
on
you
the information,
did say.
Unless there's a change in the facts and the information that brought before the board that's significant enough to warrant the change.
But the change in facts would be if we convince DOT to support the lower speed limit. And that's
exactly.
Right.
That's what I was hearing.
Exactly.
Right. I mean, does that address your concern?
Well, I mean, ultimately DOT is going to have the say on it.
Right.
But,
right.
But then a decision shouldn't be made until we continue to pursue that, and that's what we're asking.
And I guess the other point I'm making is that I don't know that I believe it's valid for staff to have, you know, if we approve this modification, for staff to state that this condition has been satisfied, given that we haven't seen construction drawings for that part of the project.
You've got to clarify the condition then.
Okay, and can we do that this evening?
If that's the board's desire, if the staff and the applicant are all here to discuss it and are on board with it?
Well, I guess at some point we should hear from the applicant on that then.
Marty, you want to say something?
Well, I was actually just going to summarize and kind of turn and say we probably should hear from the applicant what their take on that is. But if I'm hearing you correctly, basically you're saying at whatever point the Phase 3 construction plans arrive for review, we would revisit the condition and see where it goes with DOT.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. So would the applicant...
Are you guys good with that?
Yeah, would you?
I'm Jeremy Medlin. I'm with MI Homes. The access point that you're referencing, we fully know that we're going to have to come back in front of the Board of Aldermen when we proceed phases 3 and 4. So given the use with what we're trying to do with the rezoning and the increased density and the commercial component and the apartment component, the widening is subject to change, the entry point is subject to change also. So I think from our end it is open-ended right now, and I wouldn't like to propose that, you know, we'll work through that with the Board of Aldermen as we're taking phase 3 and phase 4 forward.
Okay, so you're comfortable attaching this condition to phase 3 and 4 as explicitly?
I guess my only question is what would the condition say?
It
would be determined upon phase three and phase four.
Right.
That sounds very fair.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
Are you comfortable?
I am comfortable with that.
Okay. That would work.
All right. Thank you. So, any other discussion?
No.
Is there a motion?
So moved.
So moved. It has been A1 with
the condition.
With the condition.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. No nays. Motion carries. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, John.
Is that it for Valentine then?
Did we need to close the public hearing?
Let's close now.
You want to move to close it?
No, we didn't move to close the public hearing.
Did we need to?
Do we need to? Bob, do we need to?
Do we need to close it?
I'm sorry. Do we need to?
I was concentrating on something else.
I know. I'm sorry. Do we need to? We didn't have a motion to close the public hearing.
Close the public hearing.
Move to close public
second.
Hearing.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Motion carries. Okay.
Good. Do we need to revote, or the order doesn't matter?
Why don't we revote just to have
our thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. None opposed.
See, the
heat's
motion getting
carries.
To our brains.
Yeah, we're
going to
start melting soon. Okay. So, the next item is continuation of the public hearing on Litchfield AIS conditional use.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for being open to new ideas.
Thank you. That's
neat.
We look forward to being here. Thanks for being here.
We look forward to having you. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Well, Jeff is still at the podium. This is his item to give you all an update on the questions that you all had asked as a part of the continuation of the public hearing on the Litchfield CUP. So. Jeff.
Again, this is a continuation. Any need for information from the back? Last? Okay. The applicant has listened to the board and made significant changes to the plans. You'll see their letter regarding the design changes, attachment L of the package. You'll see here proposed the plan changes. They've added a play field that meets the town standards. It meets the town width standards and square footage. They've included traffic calming in the area of the two parks, which now aren't being required to serve a playfield function, per se. They've added landscape wall around the front here, chicanes between the two parks to calm traffic, full stops at the intersections, and then added is also another chicane down here. And also they show hedges in the perimeter here. Attached is attachment M for the town's lighting policy. Reducing the number of lights, really is no guidance in the policy for that, which its main purpose is health, safety, and welfare. And so the plan is in compliance with the town's lighting policy. There are some new conditions, number 22 and 23, which pertain to staff or board requests. Condition number 22, that the applicant provide in each of the 10,000 square foot play areas a hedge or other border along the Lucas Lane frontage between the sidewalk and the play area, and the applicant provide shaded seating for in the 10,000 square foot play areas. So evidently that condition is close to being satisfied. And number 23, a new condition that the HOA and design standards document include green building guidelines for new construction and do not prohibit clotheslines, solar panels, and other renewable energy measures.
And that would include compost and what was the other one? Rain barrel collection. Is that the staff's interpretation? Look, I'm not raising my hand.
No, I would think that would be an addition to that permit.
Well. And Jeff, the question came up also in whether clotheslines includes drying racks and, like, the clothesline trees. Does it have to be as specific as that if we're asking for green building guidelines?
That would be up to the developer.
I mean, literally, we don't want to create a laundry list.
Yes. How they execute the clotheslines, they would have the final say on how that would be, what the requirements of that would be.
Jeff, and with regard to that condition, also, the Planning Board has a suggested set of guidelines that you folks could work from for that. And, in fact, I know some of those items, too, are going to be covered in our bit of legislation that is going before the General Assembly this summer. So.
Discussion? Well, there's a CUP worksheet that we need to
No one signed up to speak.
No, there are no
speakers. So we should
no speakers. So, we'll,
so moved.
Okay.
Second. Public hearing.
Second? Ready?
As long as the applicant doesn't have anything, you're all right?
You good? Okay. So all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. No one opposed? Okay.
Move that the application is complete.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Move that it complies with ordinance requirements.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Move that it's subject to conditions 1 through 18 and 20 through 23.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
And grant?
Move that the application is granted.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Matter carries. Thank you.
Thank you. Look forward to another nice project.
Yep.
Thank you.
All right. We haven't built it yet. Okay. So we have the
C2. We're continuing. Is that right?
Yeah. We're asking that this be continued to September 28th to give staff an opportunity to have a second community meeting with the residents and to see if we can get more public input.
Okay.
So
all
moving.
Right.
All
second.
Right.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. None opposed. Motion carries. And now we're on public hearing to consider miscellaneous land use ordinance, text amendments related to the invasive plants, electronic gaming operations, minor subdivisions, performance guarantees, stormwater management, and minimum lot widths.
And Chris McGuire, planning administrator, is at the podium to give you all an overview of the variety of items included
yeah.
in this.
It's a wide variety.
Yes, it is.
Yep.
The kitchen sink, everything but the
and
kitchen.
None of them invasive, right?
I just want to pull up a slide so we have a map to reference.
You think what? Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for that. Sorry for the delay. The amendments we're looking at tonight are a variety of amendments that we have put together following staff recommendations and advisory board recommendations. There are a number of items included here, the first of which is updating the list of invasive plants for the town. And the plant list that we have in Appendix E17 currently includes 45 species of plants. The changes in the ordinance will takes 34 of those plants and removes them from the list, leaves 11 of the original species that we had included, and adds in 12 new ones. These recommendations were developed by the Environmental Advisory Board, and after their review of the North Carolina Native Plant Society's recommendations for invasive species. And that society has done some work over the past 11 years since we put in place our invasive plant species list, and has looked very closely at how these plants really interact with, their concern is the interaction with native plants, native ecosystems, and so they have a series of rankings. The most severe threat is the group of plants that the EAB's list comes from. And so our list is reflective of the list with all but two species on the severe threat list from the North Carolina Native Plant Society.
Have you all had a chance to review Matthew Wansberger's memo and the EAB recommendation attached to it in terms of incorporating that into the proposed changes? Or
well,
because I see that's just dated the 15th. So
their memo really reflects information about the availability of plants in the horticultural or landscaping trade.
It was the hope of the EAB that what Matthew worked on would be incorporated, included. So
the ordinance includes the recommendations of the EAB,
including this particular recommendation.
Let me just double check.
It says it requests that we adopt the rank one list of severe threat exotic plants.
Yes,
as provided. So that's what we're doing.
That's correct.
And also recommends the list of invasive species be kept up to date by reviewing. Okay, so that's just a future recommendation. So I guess we're good then on that.
Yeah, they're hoping that we will continue to update this list. And the way the North Carolina Native Plant Society's recommendations work, they have rank one, rank two, rank three, and then they have two watch lists. So we haven't yet established a schedule, but I think we'll ask the EAB to keep reminding us of that, assessing those changes and making recommendations for further changes.
And actually, we've asked Matthew to do the same. He did a wonderful job on this.
Yeah.
He really should be commended. Thank you, Matthew, if you're listening, because he really brought this to us.
And he didn't even have to roll any big rolls of honeysuckle or anything
right.
like the last time. These changes were put in the ordinance. Okay. The second provision that's in the ordinance this evening is establishing a new definition for electronic gaming operations. This would apply whether a use that meets the definition was either principal or accessory. And there is basically an exemption within the definition for state-approved lotteries or any other nonprofit organizations, sort of sweepstakes or gaming, if they're doing it, if they're otherwise lawful and they're being operated in that fashion. This change establishes a new use in the table of permissible uses.
Can you direct me to where it specifies the nonprofit exemption?
Sure. The end of the definition, the last sentence in the definition. Sorry, let me get to that. The last sentence in the definition references lotteries and other activities. This is just a page from the table of permissible uses, Article 10 in the land use ordinance. So we'll be adding a new use classification in this location, 6.150 electronic gaming operations, with an S in the table underneath the B4 zoning district.
Trish, I understand why we're having this public hearing and why we're wanting to identify this, because even though it seems like this internet gaming is going to be the subject of legislation passed yesterday by the Senate, maybe the House soon may be outlawed, or kind of, you know, having this created just in the event it doesn't happen. But my question for you is, as I was reading up on this just a little bit, and I see that our privilege license tax that we're proposing in our ordinance is license tax in the amount of $1,000 plus $500 for each game. And I know I saw on some information that that we received in various emails, the other towns in North Carolina that have these, evidently they're kind of a bonanza. Because, for instance, Black Mountain, they have a $2,000 privilege license fee, $500 per machine. Lumberton has a $5,000 annual privilege license, $2,500 per machine. Mount Airy, $2,500 privilege fee, $500 machine. And, you know, I just wanted to offer that up for folks to think about a little bit. And I don't know if it really, again, it may be moot. Again, we may, I'm imagining these amounts are this amount because either A, it's lucrative, or B, you know, these businesses bring in other kind of concerns of the town and maybe use other town resources. And I guess I'll just ask you that, too. I know I'm sure there was something you looked at and kind of thinking what would be an appropriate type of privilege fee. And it may be out of bounds with our other fees. So.
Yeah.
Right.
It's very lucrative.
I have seen a lot of examples of them. Maybe it's not a lot. Well, a number of examples of them from around the state, different fee schedules. But really, we looked on this item to Mike's office, the town attorney's office, for a recommendation. They've worked with a lot of other towns that are working, local governments that are working on this issue, really towns, because the counties, I think, are limited to $5 per machine by what's in the general statutes now for this kind of thing. So I'll let Bob answer that question if he wants to add anything, but there's a range, I think, out there, and this is where we came down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know we've looked at this for a number of other municipalities in the state over the course of the last probably 6 months,
yeah.
And the numbers we're suggesting are numbers that we think the courts will tolerate if they're challenged. Some of those higher numbers, I mean, the purpose of some of those higher tax amounts is to keep these games out.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have to check and see how much revenue is being generated by some of those towns that are supposedly charging that much in terms of privilege license tax. It's a two-edged sword, and if you get too high, you're going to get challenged on the amount of the tax.
And in fact, there are some being challenged right now, I think,
exactly.
Right? Exactly. And some of those are those higher amounts?
Exactly.
Okay. All right, I just wanted to throw it out there.
I'm interested in, if we adopt this, removing the nonprofit exclusion, and there's two reasons for that. One is this whole electronic gaming thing is originally somebody's creative idea about how to get around gambling laws and provide this kind of gaming, this gambling. And to me, it's very feasible that someone could figure out a way to set up a nonprofit, just as someone set up an internet service, that could basically just be a front for this kind of operation. So by removing it, it means that if there's a legitimate nonprofit that wants to pursue something like this, they can come to us and we can like consider tailoring something for a legitimate operation, but rather than leaving it wide open like that.
I'd like to hear from legal staff about that.
I don't know, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with a case-by-case type of, Dan, if this is what you're talking about.
I'm just saying remove this exception.
I don't have any particular problem with removing the nonprofit exception to the, I mean, it's a policy question for you, but as a legal matter, I don't have any particular problem with removing the nonprofit exception that we built into the statute, or the ordinance, excuse me.
Yeah, Jackie. I'm concerned about the nonprofit exception because it is so open to abuse that you could set something up, like Newman's Own, and we're all, except then you take your management cut, which is 98%, and give 2% to, save the oil rigs or something, So that's why I want to not have that, because I think it's just way open to abuse. And I don't care if it's a nonprofit or a for-profit running it, it's a lousy thing, so I wouldn't want them coming in and asking to do it. But thanks for bringing that up.
Sure.
Yeah. Any other discussion? Well, there's a...
I don't know if Trish was done with her presentation.
Are you?
Well, there's a couple of other provisions in the ordinance I was going to touch on, but it's really up to you, of course. We did propose some spacing, just on this same topic, we did propose some spacing requirements between the electronic gaming operations and included a map in your packet that showed the B4 zoning district. There are spots in both the existing B4 zoning districts we have which would meet the 500-foot distance requirement from surrounding residential buildings and 1,000-foot separation requirement for the two, if there were ones locating in both of those districts. And of course, there's an hours of operation limitation proposed in this ordinance as well for these businesses, which would be from 8 in the morning until 10 in the evening. And you've talked about the privilege license tax piece, which is also a separate town code amendment if you do decide to go forward with this text amendment, including that provision. And we'll need to remove the definition from both the town code amendment and the text amendment. The next piece of this ordinance is a clarification for the definition of minor subdivisions. Currently, we have four subcategories of things included in that definition. We're proposing to remove two of them because they, in their application over the years, have just been confusing and not really helpful in terms of figuring out what should be the threshold for a project being a minor subdivision or not. So the definition as it's written, rewritten, would make subdivisions of resulting in a total of more than four lots, that involved the creation of new public streets, and did not involve the creation of public streets would make those minor subdivisions, and then if a subdivision exceeded those thresholds, then it would move up into a major subdivision and would be subject to a special use permit versus a zoning permit.
So no new streets and no more than four lots.
Exactly. That is correct. Thank you.
No, is it public dedicated streets or streets, period?
Any new public streets.
So they could put a private street on it and still make it a minor subdivision.
That's right. But that's difficult because we have a three up to, I mean, we have a, it's sometimes difficult. We have a provision that says no more than three lots can be served off a private road and without, anyway, making a finding about its relationship to surrounding development and so forth.
So why don't we just do three and under to match the road thing instead of four and under?
Oh, let's see. Well, I think the main reason is we have, because sometimes there are no private streets, there are no streets involved at all in these developments.
Okay.
They may just be a number of lots. And we've used the four lots threshold as being this cut between the zoning permit and the special use permit.
Okay.
I think that's there are situations where there's not a street
okay.
involved or a shared driveway.
I was just curious.
That reaches that threshold. Is that sufficient for an answer from your perspective, Marty? Okay. The next piece of this ordinance is modifying the provisions in the ordinance dealing with performance guarantees. This is when we authorize use or occupancy, or sale of lots prior to the completion of all of the requirements of a development. And we have these provisions in both the zoning that apply to both zoning permit projects and permits that are subject to special or conditional use permits. So the changes that are included in this ordinance do several things on this topic. They extend the bonding period, and we've made these changes to reflect basically what our practice has been, what the reality seems to be with regard to the time needed for developments to actually complete the kinds of improvements that we're talking about. This might be paving a street, installing some infrastructure, putting in recreational facilities, planting trees, things like that. This ordinance will extend the bonding period to 12 months. It will authorize the manager to approve the extension for successive periods of 12 months. It will make it clear that this is a clarification of language that's already in there. The change of reference about 12 months is a change from 10 months, which is what's in the ordinance presently. It makes it clear that the authority to do this applies to both things that are needed for the project, that is to say, things that are required to meet the ordinance to support the development of a project, as well as those things that are part of conditions that are imposed on a project. So you can bond for either of those types of things, unless the Board of Aldermen or the permit issuing authority otherwise, the staff, well, there wouldn't be a condition for the staff, but for the Board of Adjustment, has specified some date of completion or for some phasing schedule for the project. A change like that would need to go back to the permit issuing authority and wouldn't be something that could be modified by the manager in approving this kind of bonding in this situation. And as I said, these changes pertain to zoning, special use, and conditional use permits. The next change deals with changing our thresholds, really the measure for stormwater management requirements. Currently, and since we adopted these ordinance provisions in 2007, we have been using disturbed area, which is a term that comes from some other state regulations dealing with, well, a variety of things, but dealing with drinking water supply, watersheds, and other water quality related things. We found this to be problematic. We did put in place our regulations across the board throughout the town. They apply within the University Lake watershed as well as in the town itself to larger lots and smaller lots, and they've been linked in. The disturbed area was linked into a threshold. I mean, it had a threshold established for it. It was 5,000 square feet for non-residential projects or more than two units, more than duplexes, and 7,500 for single family. Types of developments. And we've just seen, you know, some difficulty in a number of situations where installation of a sewer line would on a small lot would caused the disturbed area as resulting from the house, the driveway, and a sewer line installation to exceed this threshold. For we've seen large lots where in the watershed where driveways are going in, houses are going in, septic areas are going in, they're exceeding the threshold. And we're not seeing a good balance between the improvements that are then needed, the disturbance associated with the improvements needed to meet the stormwater requirements versus the ability of the property to otherwise manage the stormwater that's generated at the end of the day when the project is completed. So we're proposing instead to use impervious surface as our measure, our threshold, the bar you have to leap over to determine whether or not you have to meet our stormwater management, that is to say water quality and quantity requirements. And we are proposing a flat 5,000 square feet for developments and then they'll be subject to the same stormwater management requirements we've had in place again since 2007. Let me just find one other note here.
Christy,
sure.
Can you comment at all as to whether there are any developments like that were recently reviewed that their status under this would be changed because of this, you know, where the disturbed land and the impervious surface actually created a either looser or tighter criteria for application?
I think there's one project that actually hasn't reached completion, which is in the northern study area in the our zoning district, a large, very large lot, over 10 acres, where they may actually still go over the threshold because they have a very long driveway. But let Marty answer this question.
Yes, there's this one project that's kind of in review, but certainly hasn't been constructed. There was another project, I guess, as a real-world example that was in the watershed. It's obviously at least 5 acres. I don't remember exactly how large the lot was, but the driveway itself was the big part of the problem. You know, they had to kind of sneak it back through the woods to get to the actual building site, and the driveway itself tripped them over the existing 5,000 disturbed area threshold, and the end result, if I might put kind of a real-world image on this, was, you know, you have a lot out in the watershed that's surrounded by forested land, and what our ordinance drove them to do was actually tear down a big chunk of this forested land to install stormwater devices where they could have just let the stormwater kind of filter through the woods. That's, if that's what you're asking about, that's kind of one real-world example of what has happened.
Okay. Correct that?
That one is completed, but yes, that would prevent that from happening again. Well, it's still going to be subject to a threshold here, but it will definitely help with most situations. That's our determination.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Lord.
Sure.
One of the other things that's in this ordinance is a clarification of how we determine what the change is from a situation with existing impervious surface to its subsequent its built out stage. So there's a clarification of that. So basically it's a subtraction. It's clearly stated that we're going to subtract the existing impervious surface out there from the developed impervious surface, and that's how we're going to determine the impervious surface on a project. Another thing that this ordinance does is really link back to our impervious surface limitations in the University Lake watershed. So we're not going to, because the University Lake watershed regulations were basically created to deal with water quality, we're going to go back and we're going to link back to the requirements or the thresholds that are specified there. So there are going to be some instances where a lot will be able to exceed 5,000 square feet in the watershed because it's already allowed under the table of impervious surface. And where they wouldn't have to go and do stormwater management requirements, and it's again linked into the size of the lot. And then specifically with respect to the B5 and the WM3, we would not make these requirements for additional stormwater management kick in until that lot had exceeded the threshold of 6% impervious, which is currently the threshold where a project in those two zoning districts has to go into dealing with stormwater management. So we're trying to make a connection back and not have parts of the ordinance that don't make sense don't work together as well as they should. This ordinance also, one of the other, I think, fairly significant pieces of it is it does propose a way for us to deal with lots that are existing commercial lots that may involve some significant change in the development of the property, but may or may not include a change, result in a net change in impervious surface. But they're located in parts of town where we really have a problem with stormwater management, with water quality. And ultimately, in connection with our responsibilities under NPDES, we've proposed in this ordinance a threshold of, you know, should a project involve or rather contain at least 10,000 square feet impervious surface, and propose significant changes to the site, such that those changes either are worth $100,000 or 50% of the value of the improvements on the land, whichever is greater. At that point, then there would have to be stormwater management sort of retrofit onto a site. So this is a change, a clarification of what's in the ordinance now. And would you add anything to that, Marty? We chose this mechanism because it's very similar to one that's used in the building permit process, in the process of establishing when projects have to meet the building code. There's a 50% threshold for when you're going to change your building enough that you've got to bring it up to basically code. So we've used the, you know, at least 10,000 square feet and then these other value criteria to deal with that.
I don't have a question. No, that was a sufficient explanation.
Okay. Thank you. Let's see. Finally, the piece of the ordinance that we have in here deals with again, something of a clarification of an existing provision. We have a presumptive lot width standard that we have had in place since, I think, the mid-1980s. So what that means is that lots don't have to necessarily meet the lot width standard. What happens if a lot that's created now doesn't meet the lot width standard? And I'm speaking of lots that are developed really outside of the architecturally integrated subdivision process, but lots that are created from the subdivision of small or medium-sized pieces of property. What happens if a lot is created like that under our ordinance, then it's not eligible, basically. The owners of that property are not ever eligible to come back and say, we need a variance from the setback requirements to be able to use our lot. They have to meet the standard setbacks for that zoning district. But we've seen some real inconsistency in sort of the way lots are created, and in some cases multiple subdivisions of property that have resulted in shared driveways, projects with a number of lots or dwelling units on them that have been developed without meeting all of the provisions of the ordinance. They don't meet the recreational facilities requirements. They don't meet the open space requirements. We've got a couple of situations where we have 15 or 20 lots. Most of these are smaller numbers of lots, but we do have a couple of examples of those. They're a very different product and a very different piece of the community in terms of the provision of shared improvements, say the curb and gutter along the front of a street or a sidewalk or something like that. They often don't result in the best street pattern. There'll be a multiple private driveways rather than connected driveways, so we'll see a number of driveways along a street rather than a shared driveway entrance, that sort of thing. So what this is proposing is some way to sort of work towards this solution. As we've mentioned in the abstract, the staff has considered recommending to the Board of Aldermen that we do away with the presumptive lot width standard, just make it a straight lot width, and that would mean every lot would, you know, there would be less flexibility for people to create a lot behind another lot or to create a number of skinnier lots along the front of a street or something like that. We feel that that's really not the best approach. The flexibility is appropriate, and that with sort of lower intensity developments, the uses on these lots are fine. So our recommendation is that any lots that are created that don't meet the presumptive lot width standard just be only eligible for single family residential uses rather than duplexes or multifamily units going in on those.
In one sentence, what it is you're recommending, because I know that outside of big new developments, Carborough has an awful lot of flag lots and infill, and I don't want to do anything to discourage that. I don't want to overregulate that or add $10,000 worth of grading to that. There are already some issues with it with the setback that it's detrimental to creating overhangs. But real simply, what is it that this is aiming to do?
If this ordinance is adopted, a lot that is created that does not meet the presumptive lot width can only be used for a single-family unit. It can't be developed large enough to put a duplex or a triplex or a quadruplex or something like that on it. So it could still have a single-family unit, so there'd be presumably one family or family unit added to that shared driveway or driveway space, and not multiple units.
I think we need to discuss this one more, and only because in a larger subdivision just maybe a month ago, we allowed them to have a modification and remove the duplexes out of it, which means they're going to put single-family homes, which means those are less affordable than a duplex or a triplex. And I'm not necessarily saying that I wouldn't vote for it, but I think I want more information from staff with regards to the number of lots that may affect, what other safeguards are there for people who live around those lots. Because really it's an issue of what I call non-homeowner association lots and homeowner association lots, because there are many more restrictions, excuse me, in neighborhoods that have that were developed under the homeowner model of development, as opposed to someone like a lot of the homes that are being sort of renovated. On the other hand, or changed, and I'm not saying that I want a duplexes where they're ranch houses now, but I think I want a little more information.
I'm a little uncomfortable with this hodgepodge of things in one agenda item. I don't think I've ever seen that before. And this one in particular, I would be much more comfortable cutting it from the herd and like Joel said, like dealing with this as a separate item where we can, I'm really scared of going, oh, okay, and then 6 months later there are some implications that I hadn't thought of, and it's costing somebody a whole lot of money or making it more complicated to build here or restricting even more the income levels of folks that live here. So I understand where staff's coming from, but I'd really like to cut this one from the pack and deal with it as a separate item.
Any other comments?
Did you have one more piece of it to tell us about?
No, that's the last provision.
That's the last one, that's section 9.
Anyone signed up to speak? I guess not.
No. There's no one signed up to speak on this.
How did we come to have all these different kinds of things in one agenda item?
Miscellaneous.
We've been, as you know, we have a very long list of amendments to the ordinance that we developed several years ago, and some of them are the higher priority items, and we're in this situation this year, we thought we're going to try and pick the ones that we can start working on these, because if we try to work on this project in its entirety, we haven't really had the opportunity to do that. So we've got a list. It's got some priorities included in it, and the ones that we picked from that first kind of round, based on some issues that are current, like the electronic gaming and some others that, like the stormwater management, that really we've been discussing in a number of instances with regard to developments, and others that we feel are problematic. Overall, we put them together for you like this. It was a timing issue for us. We wanted to try and get them, before you took summer break. So, and they are still, they are separable. There's different sections in the draft ordinance. You can certainly remove some of them if that's what you'd wish to do. For the purposes of advertising the public hearing, we were able to do one advertisement rather than multiple advertisements and so forth. So.
Well, can we ask sort of a process question? Can we approve everything but Section 9 and then continue the public hearing for Section 9 for additional information, or would staff have to republish?
Can be extracted.
Yep.
You can close the public hearing on everything except Section 9 in the proposed ordinance. Continue the public hearing to a date certain, if you choose, on Section 9 or the subject matter of Section 9, and then act on the rest of it.
Right. My suggestion was to pick the first public hearing date in October. That way, giving staff whatever. I mean, I don't want to load up September, not knowing what's going on.
We might be bringing an item to you not to meet for October 26th for a couple reasons. One, which we may be an early voting place again.
Yay.
And they've asked for that date for late hours. We're trying to work with them at the staff level to make this an early voting location. Is that correct, Matt, that one of the dates?
Well, I think they
November.
So, yeah.
I
can assume that.
Probably not.
I mean, is it
November 3rd?
The only other question I asked is there a particular urgency from staff if we continue it to November?
I mean there are projects that we've seen that do involve this last provision in particular. I think several years ago that we did a report on minor subdivisions and exempt subdivisions and how those play into our regulations entirely, and looked at some strategies for trying to manage them a little bit more. This is one strategy to try and do that, because we do see some projects involving the creation of a number of lots that don't meet the standards, and so consequently, you know, along the street it may have single family and the back multiple duplexes and that sort of thing, and shared driveways and multiple driveways, and you know, lack of attention to other provisions in the land use ordinance. But
does this in any way have any implication for folks who could potentially build rental units for students? Is there any?
Yeah, I mean, yes.
Everything does.
From
everything
a timing produces. Standpoint, if I could interject, yeah. I don't believe we're overloaded right now for that public hearing date
September.
In September, if you wanted to want to continue.
Is it the 27th? September 27th? Is that it?
I think it's the 28th.
That we close the public hearing.
Do we have a second? With the exception
continue
of
continue Lockwood until September 28th.
Second.
Well, those in favor?
Aye.
And then opposed? Okay, the motion carries. So
move the resolution of consistency for all the items except the minimum lock widths.
Do I have a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And then opposed? Motion carries. And
move the ordinance excluding the lock widths and. Is that where I want to specify excluding, removing the nonprofit?
And the nonprofit.
Yeah.
So,
and removing the nonprofit exemption.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
None opposed? It carries.
And move the town code amendment.
Move, pardon? What did you say?
The town code amendment.
Oh,
with this also
yes.
Striking the nonprofit C. exclusion.
Okay. Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
And none opposed. Motion carries.
And
Jackie's trying to interject something.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that because number 9 is a continued public hearing, I would like it to get the attention and the publicity and the notification as if it were its own standalone public hearing so that people hear about it, and I don't want it just appearing and nobody knew it was coming up.
I don't know for the rest of the board, but if you could send us what you sent us about minor subdivisions and that interplay, that might be helpful to refresh our memories. And if you could sort of bring back, and I'm going to ask for visuals, and because one of the things I was thinking about is that development on... Is it Hillsboro? I'm going to close my eyes while I'm driving.
Fayetteville?
No, Hillsboro. Hillsboro, the set of small rental houses that are, I think, it's next to the kind of apartment building.
Oh, yeah.
How that would be informed, plus what's on going closer to Town Hall with that development with the sort of townhomes behind the, in between the two.
Cedars?
No, it's not Cedars. It's in between, it's just in between two houses. It's right across from.
West Main Street?
Yes. I mean, that kind of would be helpful in terms of informing how the, in, at least in my mind, how it would be applied. Sometimes got to have pictures, visuals.
Not a problem.
Okay.
Thank you. Sure, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for that.
Go ahead, Jackie.
I really understand staff, how much... how overworked staff is right now and all the pressure on staff. I feel like I just went through a combination of a public hearing and consent agenda. And I'm just a little uncomfortable with that. I think it was an awful lot all at once. And I worry about the details that maybe slipped by and that there were some things on here that maybe... Anyway, I understand why it happened. I'm not comfortable with a consent agenda public hearing. So just putting that out there. Thank you.
I would want to say, not on this issue, but I love the planners on the new, those big, huge planners.
Isn't that cool?
That is so great. Big hand for Public Works.
Yay.
Lovely. You know, they have these now big planners.
At the Andrew Rigsby parking lot.
At the Andrew Rigsby parking lot.
Oh, yeah.
Great. Just.
And good reuse.
Yeah.
Okay.
Big hand clap.
We have one more item, and that's a continuation of the public hearing on the ordinance amending the land use ordinance provisions dealing with the stream buffers in accordance with Jordan Lake rules.
Move to pass from A.
Do I have a second?
Just continuing.
Second.
Okay. Second.
All right. All those. Yep.
You can come back in November.
It's continued.
It's just continued.
It's just continued.
We don't have
to
November.
Yeah.
We'll give you an opportunity.
And the reason is we continued to await word from the state, and that's why when we put it on the agenda item, we said that we're asking that it be continued to November. It's not because we're dragging our feet. It's just we can't get the response from the state on what we've submitted.
And, Jay, that's November 23rd. All righty, and there's, I'm going to make a motion to adjourn, and there's a request for a...
Yeah, before you return...
Motion to go into...
Closed session.
Closed session for personnel
items.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And opposed? Motion carries.